in this room with another group.
Third floor in a debate.
Well, they looked like they were engaged in.
Good afternoon. I'll call to order the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. It is Wednesday, November 18th at 2 o'clock. Welcome. What a crowd today. This is exciting. So we're just going to jump right into the agenda, and I will open an informational hearing on public contracting and invite up our invited speakers of Diane Lancaster and Robert Underwood. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed in whatever order works for you.
Thank you. Representative Fagan, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, I'm Diane Lancaster, the Chief Procurement Officer at the Department of Administrative Services. It's a pleasure to be here today. I have with me Robert Underwood, who is the project manager assigned by our director's office to help with the implementation of House Bill 2375, which this legislature passed last year in the 2015 session. So, first things first. We were tasked with the duty to report back to an interim committee in November, and we have a written report that is being finalized and will be delivered to you shortly in the next few days. But today, I'm going to just give you a few highlights of the work that we've done on the report so that you get a sense of where we are. And then Robert's going to give some information about how we're doing with the other tasks in that bill. House Bill 2375 has a subsection, and it's number 5, which asked us to develop and evaluate advice and recommendations about best practice in public procurement. Mm-hmm. It also asked us to consider peer review and what sort of system or shared experience or how can we make sure that we are learning and working towards best practice. And finally, to come before you and to give you our evaluation of the good ideas and how we might use good ideas that we've learned to make public contracting in this state better than it is today. So first of all, we looked at best practice. And in best practice, there are a number, in fact, there's probably too many different sources of best practice. The legal profession has best practice books and volumes and training, both at the Oregon level and at the national level. There is the National Association of State Procurement Officers, the National Institute of Government Purchasing, the Universal Certification Board that certifies professional public procurement officers. There are colleges and universities. There are lots and lots of materials. So we dialed down and we chose a selected group of best practice checklists, which you will see in the written report. We picked the areas that we felt related to accountability in public procurement because that is, frankly, the big theme of this House bill. And when we looked at Oregon and we started comparing item by item our work to those in a national best practice standards, we were very relieved, frankly, to find that, as we frankly knew, I think, that Oregon's statutory and rule structure align very well and with the broadly accepted national best practices in public procurement. So the structure is pretty good. And that, I think, you can take credit for here at the legislative body. Now, when we come to peer review, that was an item in the law that was not defined. It just said, look at peer review, think about a system of developing or implementing peer review. So we looked at kind of the broad array of formal and informal devices. And again, procurement people in Oregon benefit from a variety of resources. I don't know if this group has been told about, but we have a designated procurement officers grouping. It is a lateral recognition of all the procurement officers in state agencies. They are called designated procurement officers, and their role is spelled out in administrative rule. They meet once a month, and they share and they network about issues, concerns, they receive information. And so this is one way to have sort of an informal lessons learned. We talk about projects and that type of thing so that we can share. More formal peer review is done, of course, by the Secretary of State. It's done by internal auditors in the larger agencies. We have customer utility boards, which I suspect you may have heard about by now. These are our customer boards. They are made up of representatives of state agencies who come together, and they evaluate and work with program areas in DAS, like our procurement services group, around rate setting and budgets and business plans and service issues. And if there are complaints or problems, things that surface, lessons to be learned, they talk about those as well. Finally, in the more formal category, we have the Department of Justice. And the Department of Justice plays a key role in assuring the quality of our solicitations and our contract documents. House Bill 2375, for instance, actually gives the Department of Justice the authority to declare templates and forms that will be used and are mandated to be used by state agencies in their work. And this should bring more consistency, more standardization to the process. That all comes into effect January 1st, so there will be a lot of action happening in January as those templates start coming out. Agency teams, then, there are many agencies, including DAS, that form teams to process solicitations and contracts and then to work with contract administration. And there are networks in the procurement community again. I think the key finding that you'll see in our report is that while best practice is well known and there is no question what should be done, the application of best practice is inconsistent. Some agencies, small agencies, may struggle because they don't have a lot of resources that are trained in procurement. Larger agencies, just by the virtue of their size and the nature of the projects that they undertake, may also struggle. We looked at all the ideas and we talked to a number of people, and I think the consensus around the community that I work with is that training and dispersing all this information about best practice is probably one of the best things we can be doing in order to help get everyone up to speed. It's particularly difficult when an agency has field offices. We have training that is given by us and by other agencies here in Salem, face-to-face. Sometimes we take it on the road, but that's costly and it's very time-consuming, and it's very difficult to reach everybody that's involved. The Department of Human Services, for example, estimates they may have 500 to 1,000 people scattered around the state who have significant contract administration duties. So the challenge is how to get training and support to those folks out in the field. And this is typical of many agencies. So House Bill 2375 adds a mandate to the efforts that we already have underway that will require us to, in this coming year, set standards for training, education, experience for all the folks in state government agencies who do have significant duties in contract management and contract administration. The way we're going to have to do that is by creating different vehicles to deliver training. And so DAS is talking with local college, local university, about helping us to build some online capacity in order to deliver training out to the field, to bring it to the desktop, so to speak. And we think that effort is well worth the time. Finally, I think House Bill 2375 really underscores this need to broaden the reach of solid best practice in public contracting beyond just the professionals. I think that's one of the most important features of the bill, is to say everyone in state government who touches and works with a contract or a contractor really needs to have knowledge about how to do that and how to gain the ultimate success and get the best value for the dollars that we are spending. And so that, I think, is something for all of us to be pleased with about this particular piece of legislation. We're working on rules. We're doing other assessments of the bill. This bill has several working parts to it. And so I have with me Robert Underwood, who is going to give you some information about the other efforts that we're taking, the activities underway, sort of our update on timelines, and of course we're available for questions.
Okay. And we'll have Mr. Underwood present, and then I'll open it up for questions to both of them if you have
Thank
questions.
You.
Go ahead.
I'm Robert Underwood, Strategic Initiatives Coordinator in the Office of the COO at DAS. I've been brought in to help DAS with the implementation of House Bill 2375. This follows on from my experience working on the Enterprise Procurement Improvement Project, which has been running within the Strategic Initiatives team at DAS for a couple of years now. The bill has, in addition to the report, three other main areas that we've been working to implement. Two of them take effect from January 1 next year. The first one of those is the requirement that agency directors review the procurement advice that they procurement team have received before a contract is executed. This requirement what we've done to help with this requirement is raise awareness within agencies by undertaking some outreach. We've provided some general advice for agencies so that they can implement the bill effectively. And we've provided some basic examples of documentation that agencies can use so they have a consistent approach to reviewing their contracts and their advice before they sign off on those documents. DAS and DOJ have also been discussing ways that they can compile the advice that they give during the process of building a contract into a simple document that can help with that review. There are some procurements that take place over an extended period of time, and obviously for a director to be able to review that advice, it needs to be in a nice, concise, consistent format. So DAS and DOJ have been looking at how they can bring that advice together. The second aspect that goes into effect on January 1 is templates. The Enterprise Procurement Improvement Project has been working collaboratively with agencies to develop procurement templates over the last year or more. This bill means that we have the opportunity to mandate the use of those templates. Up until this point, it's been voluntary. We have worked collaboratively with agencies to make sure that there is a lot of buy-in with the templates, and the first templates that we do implement from January 1 will be ones that the procurement community is familiar with, that they have helped build, and so hopefully there'll be less friction in getting those used and out there and improving process. After those initial templates, there'll be continued collaborative efforts to develop further templates and roll those out over time. The final part of the bill, which is a significant training portion that Diane's already spoken about, is to implement standards and training for procurement and contract administration staff. This has a longer timeline. The training has to be available by the end of 2017, and all procurement and contract administration staff have to be trained by the end of 2018. So we are spending some time setting up a system to do this effectively. From the beginning of next year, we'll start meeting with subject matter experts from across the enterprise to put together a structure around the procurement people that will be affected by this training to assess the skills and knowledge needed for each role in the procurement process, try and create some form of levels so that there is appropriate training that can be adjusted for the level of responsibility the complexity of the procurements for each different type of employee. And then once those standards are established for each group, make sure that there is suitable training available to help procurement staff best benefit from that information and knowledge to do their jobs. And then once we've agreed all those standards and developed that training, we'll make sure that there's a system in place that will track the training that an employee has undertaken or any other existing experience and knowledge that they bring to their roles so that we can make sure that each employee is meeting the standards that have been developed for them to have the best knowledge to do their jobs. Those are the remaining parts of the bill that we're working on, and then we're open to questions.
Thank you both very much. Questions for... Yes, Representative McLean.
I was just wondering, how many people do you have to consider training? Do you know what's the number? Because I think it's a big difference. I think the online idea sounds great if it's a large number. Mm-hmm. But the training, I mean, you can get the information. So how do these folks support each other after they've taken the class? Or
sure. Representative Fagan, Representative McLean, it is a challenge. There's no question. As I said, DHS, 500 to 1,000 people around the state. ODOT, probably 300 to 500 people around the various regions. Department of Corrections, mm-hmm. Department of Forestry, Fish and Wildlife. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the list goes on. So it is in the thousands mm-hmm. of people who have what we believe fairly significant roles. Mm-hmm. And they range, these folks will range in types of position, from the more administrative support people to very high-level project managers, that type. So you're going to have a range of capabilities and a range of duties, mm-hmm. And of course, locations. Online training is definitely, to us, a high priority because of that dispersed group. And while you can, and I understand, yes, you can deliver training, you can make sure people take it through a competency test, mm-hmm. and that can be done online so that you know that they've done it, they've answered questions, and they've demonstrated some sort of competency in it. And, of course, then there's how does it work in real life, then, mm-hmm. from there.
Yeah.
The jury will be out for some time to see mm-hmm. what sort of improvements we might see, but I believe that with time, and this, you know, we're going to all be watching this and working this together, I suspect, we should start to see more comprehension, more understanding. My office, I'll tell you one informal measure I have are the number of calls and emails that I get from agency people. And I've been paying more and more attention to, are those calls, where are they coming from?
Mm-hmm.
And generally, as you would suspect, it's in the Salem big administrative area.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we're going to see increased interest and awareness, and that's going to put more demand, of course, on the procurement professionals in every agency to be helping and supporting those folks after training, in between training, and the like. Again, with the Procurement Council, we are talking about this every month. And so I think it'll be a good journey, and I think we'll be all doing it together.
Thank you. Representative Buehler.
Can I just ask you about best practices a little bit?
Certainly.
Is it best practice to put out a contract to competitive bidding?
Representative Fagan, Representative Buehler, that is a very essential question.
Yeah.
Oregon statute supports open, transparent competition at every level of dollar purchase. We do allow small purchases under $10,000 to be made on a direct award basis, but even there we recommend some kind of competitive quote process. When you get into anything over $10,000, there is a mandated expectation by law that you will do a competitive process. Now, as you understand, the Public Procurement Code is divided into two major pieces. One of them is called Chapter 279B, goods, trade services, professional services. The other is 279C, which is about public improvement or construction.
Okay.
In construction, we have preserved a tradition in this state that public improvement will be competitively bid, and generally the award is going to go to the lowest responsive and responsible bidder. That is somewhat in contrast to awarding based on best qualifications. So, for example, architects and engineers, we look at the qualifications really before we look at price. So I think the answer depends. There are different methods, but at the end of the day, everything is fundamentally public record. Everything must be noticed to the public in Oregon. Everything must be open and transparent, and all of this information available to anyone, any company, anybody who wants to participate.
Yes.
So larger contracts are certainly encouraged to be put out to competitive bids.
Absolutely.
How about exclusive contracts? Is that best practice?
Representative Fagan, Representative...
Multi-year exclusive contracts.
Sure. Representative Buehler, there are occasions where you have to have an exclusive contract for many years. The example that comes to my mind is in information technology would be software maintenance, for example. If you have a software system, a particular type, you're going to need particular maintenance for that.
Right.
You also might have things in buildings like elevators or other maintenance systems, which by their nature, you're going to have people who are skilled in installing and servicing that particular type of equipment.
Yeah.
So the range of exclusive contracts sometimes still can be bid because there might be service providers who could work with that particular product. Sometimes, if it's into a copyright, material, something that is absolutely unique, then it's called a sole source, and the law allows, under certain justifications, to that you can go ahead and do that. But it has to be documented.
Okay. So if it's a very competitive industry, exclusive contracts aren't so important, like a travel agency or something like that.
Representative Fagan, Representative Bugle, you're absolutely right, Representative. If it's something where there's a lot of competition available, such as a travel management company, then open competition would be the absolute best practice to pursue.
Just one more question.
Yes.
Is it best practices for the state to give financial assistance to a contractor to help them with their business?
Representative Fagan, Representative Bugle, in strictly within the Public Procurement Code, which is where I operate, we do not offer financial support to a business. That in Oregon could be available to businesses through a number of other means, the Oregon Business Development Department, for example, and other sources of help. We do not ourselves engage in that, but there are programs that certainly might offer that help. And I'm thinking of some of the housing programs that group homes or other supported housing situations where you might have a different relationship.
I'm talking to a private business.
Oh, to a private business, sir. Generally not. Generally not.
Just one final question.
Yes.
I don't know if you're aware of the article a few days ago in the Willamette Week about our contracting with Azumano Travel with regards to
Representative
exclusive
Fagan.
Contract.
Oh, Representative Fagan, Representative Bugle. No, I have not read the article.
I recommend that you do so.
Certainly.
I think we should really look carefully at this and try
Certainly.
To prevent this type of arrangement in the future. But all of those things, long-term exclusive contract, lack of competitive bidding, financial assistance to a private business, were done.
Yes.
Will this bill prevent that kind of behavior in the future?
Representative Fagan, Representative Bugle, I think this bill goes a long way to underscore and reiterate the policy of the legislative body. The Public Procurement Code contains a pretty powerful piece of policy statement at the beginning of the code. In the case that, and sometimes there is misunderstanding about what is exclusive or what is non-exclusive, and people use different words, but the code straightens all that out. And there are definitions in the code for any of these practices that state agencies might want to do. If you do it right, you should not have a problem. And I wouldn't want to speak to the specifics about that till I read the article. But generally, that would be an area where there should be competition. And we can certainly get back with some information on that particular one if you'd like.
Get back to me what happened here and what the repercussions for not following the code and best practices. I'd like to see that included in the bill.
Certainly, sir. I'll be glad to do that.
Thank you, Diane. Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. And thank you for your testimony, Ms. Lancaster. Mm-hmm. So I just, one thing that I'm kind of thinking about, and I have a little bit of experience with this, is if you whip the horse too hard, after a while the horse doesn't have the ability to run anymore. And so I worry that if I'm in favor of this bill and the concepts behind this bill, but there's something that's maybe the dog that doesn't bark, and that's the ability for the state to act nimbly and quickly in executing a contract. Now, I think you have two examples I'll bring up, and they're both IT examples, so maybe that's we can put that in its own little world maybe for contracting. But I think there's probably examples of it in other contracting. So, like, for instance, when the state was working with Oracle on the Cover Oregon project there, I think that they were on a compressed timeline there, and that didn't go so well. Okay. I'm also working with the DMV on oversight of their service transformation project there. And I'm seeing the opposite thing there of it seems like there's so much attention to the procurement process that they're losing traction, and I would say even adding risk to the project by not being able to nimbly contract. So maybe you can just speak off the cuff just in general on that
sure.
factor, what your experience is with
Representative Fagan, Representative Nierman, thank you for your question. I think what you're posing are sort of opposite ends, perhaps, of a spectrum. Balance, as usual in business, you want to achieve a balance. And on the one hand, because of the time constraints and the federal issues and everything that was going on with the health insurance exchange, it may have been too compressed. On the other hand, with the DMV transformation, are we spending more time chewing on the procurement process than we need to? It's hard to tell. In the DMV situation, there are many different systems that have been legacy systems in place for many years. And my understanding of the transformation from a procurement angle is that they are trying to draw these in and to create a new systemic approach to their service needs. That can take quite a while to really get all the business requirements known and worked through and documented. One of the things that I know takes time is the translation of information technology service requirements into written word, into procurement solicitation documents that the general business community that supplies information technology can receive, understand very clearly, and give clear proposal back. And in a situation as large as the transformation project, there are going to be a number of different program areas that have to be engaged. There would be certainly, how do you keep the legacy systems going until you transfer over? How does all that transitioning work? Department of Justice is closely engaged with that project. We have staff working with them. There's a large team of people that meet regularly to work with that project and push it forward. And so those are the things that I know about. Everyone wants to move along and achieve the goal. And I don't know if that helps answer your question.
No, thanks. That is helpful.
You're welcome, sir.
Representative Stark?
Thank you, Chair. Just to follow up with Rep. Bueller's comments a minute ago, I would be interested in knowing that same information, especially with Zumano. As I went on the Oregon-China delegation trip, not the one with the governor, but we met up with the governor there, and we were encouraged to use them. We called and found out the prices for our tickets and so forth were almost double. And so we went with an outside travel agency, and that just made no sense to me. So to have you here, knowing that you can look into that, we look forward to hearing what goes on with it.
Thank you, and I'll be happy to do that.
Maybe you could give us
follow-up?
Yeah, why the tickets would be double.
Representative Fagan, Representatives Bueller and Stark, I know this will be informal because I do not have the facts before me, but in the travel management contract, I know travel management is it's a complex area. There are different classes of tickets. Mm-hmm. And so, first of all, you're trying to find the lowest available airfare. Which is mandated in that arrangement. You're trying to find routing that serves the needs. There are tickets that are classed as that can be changed without penalty, and there are tickets then that are cheaper, but you cannot change unless you pay a penalty. Days of the travel, where you leave, where you enter, can sometimes impact cost. Again, without details, I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly why, but there are often reasons why when you go on to Expedia or one of those sites, you might find a ticket price that looks substantially lower than one that you're quoted by the state travel agency. And there could be very legitimate reasons for that distinction. So, again, without the details, I wouldn't be able to give you exact knowledge, but it is a complex pricing structure from in that travel industry.
You want to follow?
Yeah, I think less interested in that detail than just why we deviated from such standard practices over such a long period of time in an industry that's very competitive.
That's
the question.
Well, and Representative Fagan, Representative Bueller, I can tell you that I actually participated in the competitive solicitation of that travel management contract when I was doing transaction work for some time. And that contract was competitively bid. I'm not sure for the last go-round what that, you know, what the article is saying, and we'll get into that, and we'll get back to you on that.
Follow up? Yeah, I think it says since 2005, but you can find that.
Yeah, and I'll be happy to do that.
Great. Any other questions? Would you like Mr. Underwood to repeat everything that she said just in his accent, just so that it's interesting? No? No takers? Okay. All right. I guess you guys are off the hook. Rackowitz, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah. Rackowitz, and you wanted him to? In your accent? Okay. All right, and that is the extent of our invited testimony for that. So I'm going to close the informational hearing on public contracting and open an informational hearing on an overview of DCBS. And welcome Pat Allen.
There we go. Thanks, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which is the state's largest consumer protection and business regulatory agency. Happy to spend a few minutes today talking about the department generally, and specifically about how we approach consumer protection, the way we're organized, the work we do, and how we approach that work. Our mission is to serve and protect consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate in the state. And that mission, if you listen carefully, has got two halves around consumers and workers and around a positive business climate in the state. And we take those two halves very seriously for a couple of important reasons, of course. Having a thriving business climate in the state is fundamental to a lot of what we need to do. But also from a consumer protection standpoint, our belief and approach is that vigorously competitive markets are themselves a valuable tool for consumers. Having a bunch of banks or a bunch of credit unions or any number of mortgage lenders or stockbrokers or insurance companies that you can take your business to if you're not happy where you're being served is itself a profoundly powerful consumer protection tool. If you look just in the health insurance marketplace, about 2 years ago, the American Medical Association released a report that said Oregon at that time, and I don't think it's changed significantly, had the most competitive individual health insurance market in the country. Today, we've got well over a dozen insurance companies that provide hundreds of different policy options to Oregonians, and as a result, we have very competitive individual health insurance rates in the state. And we've got a range of, according to satisfaction surveys done by the federal government as a part of the Affordable Care Act last year, a range of different kinds of consumer experiences that that people can have as they are, levels of satisfaction they can get with different companies, and they've got really meaningful choices where they can pick up their business and take it elsewhere, and that doesn't exist in all parts of the country. Some places where there perhaps are just one or two health insurance companies creates a very different market dynamic. So we really look at that business climate function as a big piece of what we do. When we think about consumer protection, if you look at the graphic there, you'll see sort of three overlapping spheres, and I'll spend just a minute talking about each of them. There's a fundamental activity that we do as a regulator where we do some kind of licensing, chartering, or examination work. We grant an entity authorization to do a particular line of business that you have decided over time it needs to be a regulated line of business. So we'll grant a bank charter or a credit union charter. We'll license someone to sell securities. We'll license someone to do work as a plumber or an electrician. It's that basic notion of you have to meet some kind of a threshold criteria that can be as simple as taking a test and paying a fee, or as complex as what goes into chartering a new bank. And you're then granted authority to do business, and we periodically examine you to make sure that you're continuing to maintain the standards that you needed to maintain to receive that charter. We also then set and enforce standards, and this runs a huge gamut in what the agency does. As an agency, we focus not just on consumer protection, but also things like construction standards around the state, worker safety standards. In all these cases, there's some element of setting an objective standard for an entity or an individual to follow, and then checking up to see that they're following those standards. So from a construction standpoint, we'll establish plumbing or electrical codes, and then issue permits either ourselves directly or through local jurisdictions, for work to be done that's inspected to make sure it met that standard. We'll establish financial safety and soundness standards for insurance companies or for banks, and we examine them to make sure that they're continuing to follow those standards. We establish consumer protection standards for entities like consumer loan organizations or mortgage lenders, and we do compliance examinations to follow up to see that they're in fact following those standards. And then the third area that we do our work is through education and advocacy, and I'll talk in a minute a little bit more about advocacy, but a well-informed consumer is able to look after their own interests in a way that is difficult for us to do on their behalf. We have functions that try to step in and act in that kind of a role, but helping people make good, informed decisions is a key piece of our function. Let me talk about a couple of areas. We operate a partially federally funded program called the Senior Health Insurance Benefit Assistance Program, or SHIBA. This is a small office a small function in our office that works with a network of volunteers around the state during Medicare open enrollment to help seniors navigate what can be a really complex and confusing landscape around Medicare Advantage and Medigap plans, and help them ask questions and look at policies and make choices that are right for them. Similarly, on a much larger scale and new to us as of July 1st, we have the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace as a part of the department, and their function on a large scale is to provide the means by which Oregonians can look at that range of nearly a dozen companies with over 100 different plans and try to make some intelligent purchasing decisions about health insurance that's good for them. And really, that role fundamentally is an educational role, not a regulatory role. Just to quickly orient you, and I won't spend a bunch of time on this, but the department is organized into a set of functional structures, and I'm going to come back to this because we're doing some reorganizing, but I talked about the fact that we've got areas that are focused on consumer protection. That's our insurance division and our division of finance and corporate securities. We do other things through the building codes division, Oregon OSHA, the workers' compensation division, which administers the system of workers' compensation insurance companies that help people get payment for medical treatment when they're injured on the job, or income replacement if they suffer some sort of loss of work. The Workers' Compensation Board is a specialized adjudicatory body that we provide their administrative services, but they're an independent body. And then we have, of course, central services. But consumer protection largely is done through the Insurance Division and the Division of Finance and Corporate Security. So let me take a minute to talk specifically about the work that we do in each of those areas. First, in insurance regulation, this is actually the very oldest part of the agency. This role was created in the 1870s originally as a part of the Secretary of State's office. We regulate the safety and soundness of insurance companies to make sure that they're going to be able to pay claims. We regulate the claims payment practices of insurance companies in a variety of fields across all lines of insurance. And we have varying degrees of rate oversight authority depending on the line of insurance. For most of the insurance that we regulate, say your car insurance policy, we have a system that's called file and use. A company will file its rate filings with us, but will immediately begin using that rate. We have actuaries who will examine those rates for some degree of actuarial reasonableness, but the notion of an unreasonable rate being filed is fairly rare. And part of the check for that, again, is back to the notion of a competitive marketplace, that you literally have hundreds of choices of auto insurance companies to be able to take your business to if you don't believe you're getting a fair rate. And so the combination of spot oversight on the rate side, plus consumer sovereignty to pick a different insurer, helps enforce that. In individual health insurance and small group health insurance, we have actual explicit rate setting authority, rate oversight authority. Those companies each year in the spring make filings with us, extensive filings that are filed on a public system that's available on the internet to anybody who wants to be able to peruse their filings. They make arguments about what their rates should be. We usually have some back and forth. If you really want an exciting afternoon, watch some actuaries at the insurance companies arguing with actuaries in our agency about what those rates should be, and we ultimately make final rate filing decisions, again, in the individual and small group health insurance markets, and that covers probably 300,000 Oregonians, so a minority share of where people get health insurance, but a significant slice of Oregonians through that process. I talked about advocacy and education. You have perhaps seen some of the advertising we've done for consumer advocacy. This is a function that we think is very important. We have a team of consumer advocates who specialize in insurance work. Any Oregonian who's having some kind of an issue with their insurance company is able to call us and have one of these folks work with them. And what work with them means runs a huge gamut from helping them understand what their policy says and what they're supposed to do to file a claim or helping them understand that something they thought maybe was covered isn't covered, just a basic education function, up to intervening on their behalf with an insurance company, sometimes simply persuading a company to take a second look at an issue. You see here the a billboard ad that that we use that is around, well, they said my car was totaled. I don't think that's right. What about that? We can call a company and have them relook at a decision like that, all the way up to identifying and forwarding for investigatory work things that we find to be actual violations of the insurance code or a pattern of behavior that we think is illegal. And you can see some statistics there in terms of data for the full year of 2014. We've been able to recover $2.3 million for Oregon citizens from their insurance companies. And this is all done free of charge. It's part of the assessment that we collect from insurance companies, so the companies really are paying for this function. You don't need to get an attorney engaged or any of those kinds of things when we use the advocacy function. Just a couple of other quick things around some of the insurance work that we've done on consumer protection. We've spent a lot of time in the last year on insurance network adequacy, and this particularly right now, this has been an interesting time around health insurance where companies are working very hard to do things like use narrow networks as a way to manage costs, while patients are trying to get to see the medical service providers they want to see or they're used to seeing. And so we've been working with the industry and with patient advocates over the course of better than a year now, and with a bill in the last session to deal with what are the standards for what's an adequate network, and how do we make sure consumers have got access to that information and are able to make an informed choice about where they get their health insurance. Oops. I thought I had a slide about wildfires. There we are, wildfires. We spent some time in a couple of our divisions dealing in response to the wildfire situation in Northeast Oregon. As you'll recall, there were dozens of homes and other buildings completely destroyed as a result of those fires. And in two different areas, both in the insurance division and in building codes, we went out on the ground in Northeast Oregon to do some extensive work with those folks to help them identify what are the things they needed to be able to do to file successful claims with their insurance companies. We got into arcane issues of insurance policies, like is a fence covered? Well, it depends if the fence is fencing in a pasture or is it fencing in the home place. It may or may not be covered. What about a bridge from where the house is to an outbuilding? What about outbuildings? Those kinds of things. And so we've worked with folks to help resolve those kinds of claims. We've also tried to make it abundantly clear to the insurance companies that we're watching their claims payment practices exceptionally carefully in this area and try to make sure that they get these decisions right the first time. We're also working with insurance companies on some things you might not think about in urban areas but are important in rural areas, like the supply of contractors is small enough that most policies have a standard provision that you have to do reconstruction within a year. Well, with construction seasons and access to contractors, that may be pretty hard in Northeast Oregon, and so we're working to try to see if we can make sure that doesn't become a problem. We also work through the building codes division on some issues about how to deal with the permitting and inspections and things that would follow as a result of going out to rebuild. The building code says you can rebuild to the code that was in force at the time your structure was built. And we may or may not have any idea what the code was at the time that some of these older structures in that part of the state were built. And so we came up with a fairly standard, using a set code that's a reasonably modern code, but not a code that imposes a lot of expensive reconstruction requirements on folks. We came up with some streamlined permitting processes and worked to make that process as simple as we could for folks out there. All right, let me turn to financial institutions and services. This is the work that's done through the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. Here what we do is we regulate depository institutions, that's banks, credit unions. There are still some descendants of savings and loans out there, although not but a couple of them anymore in the state. But again, similar to insurance companies, the idea is regulating them for financial safety and soundness. In insurance, the state is the sole regulator of the insurance industry. In depository financial institutions, we share regulatory responsibility with the federal government. Every depository institution will have two regulators, either two federal regulators or a federal and a state regulator. We regulate state-chartered banks, credit unions, and other depository institutions, and we always share that responsibility with the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation because you're required in Oregon to have FDIC insurance if you're doing business. We also regulate a number of entities that provide consumer loans, either mortgage-related, which is the largest portion of the program, or there are still a few retail consumer lending shops out there, and we regulate those folks. And then we have kind of a hodgepodge of small regulatory financial service products that I guess I would characterize by saying over the years you all have collectively decided that these things should be regulated, and since they have to do with money, we should regulate them. And so money transmitters, Western Union, sending money to relatives somewhere else, pawn brokers, often regulated as much for their potential role in stolen property as for their role in the financial services sector. Check cashers, which had a lot of attention from this body about 6 years ago in terms of abusive lending practices, those kinds of organizations. There are things that we used to regulate that we have stopped regulating. We used to regulate have a small regulatory role in travel sales, which really was found not to be providing a meaningful regulatory benefit, and so we brought a bill several years ago that proposed to end that regulation, and we did that as well. Let me talk about one area in finance and corporate securities that you may have some interest in. It's gotten a lot of attention lately. It's around the issue of crowdfunding. Mm. This is Oregon is actually a national leader in the area of crowdfunding. According to the Wall Street Journal, we have 20% of all active crowdfunding offerings that are currently open nationwide right now in Oregon. Now, that's off a fairly small base, so I wouldn't get too carried away with that. We have 20 filings to date, 18 active campaigns that are going on. What crowdfunding is basically is an attempt to provide more than Kickstarter, where you're basically contributing money to a business for a good idea and you're going to get, if you'll pardon the phrase, just a tchotchke for it, you know, some kind of either a product or some kind of a something. In crowdfunding, you're going to get actual equity in the business. And so the trick for us has been how to balance providing meaningful access to small businesses for equity capital while still protecting consumers in an area that could have just catastrophic potential for doing serious harm to people. We think we've come up with a set of standards that kind of thread that needle reasonably well. A crowdfunded business can't raise any more than $250,000. They have to have 50 or fewer employees. And most importantly, an individual investor can't invest more than $2,500. And so what we're really doing is minimizing the exposure that an individual faces if they do end up, despite our best efforts, to getting into a circumstance that they shouldn't have gotten into. This is just a listing of a few other things that we do in the area of consumer protection. Auto Loans LLC and Iris Capital Management are both examples of cases where we've worked in partnership with Department of Justice to pursue known bad actors and work on consumer recovery or restitution for folks who were taken advantage of in one sense or another. Bank on Oregon is an effort in partnership with banks and credit unions to get access to banking services and financial literacy education to low-income Oregonians, basically as an alternative channel to try to get folks into, as opposed to the check cashing and payday loan financial sector, because it's essentially better for them. Last thing I want to talk about, and then I'll see if you have questions. If you look at the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities and the Insurance Division, you find a lot of similarities in what they do, with the differences really being who it is exactly that they're doing those regulatory activities with. And historically, we're organized the way we have been for a quarter century since we were formed along product lines, banking program, credit union program, insurance program, and so on. I started my own career in the banking industry in 1981, and in 1981 and in 1992, when we were formed, a bank was actually in a really different line of business than a credit union, which was in a very different line of business than an insurance company. Well, today, banks, credit unions, insurance companies all take deposits, all make loans, and all sell insurance. And the entire financial services industry really is like that. It's fully integrated, offering a full range of products and services across what used to be hard and fast business lines and regulatory lines, and our structure really hasn't kept up. And so what we're going to be doing effective the first of the year is merging the Insurance Division and the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities into a single yet-to-be-named division that will be responsible for regulating in a holistic fashion the financial services industry in Oregon. Rather than being organized in product-specific lines, we'll be organized along functional lines, so financial safety and soundness, irrespective of the nature of the institution, compliance, irrespective of the particular chapter of ORS that we're trying to pursue, licensing, and so on through about six different functional areas. There will be some complexity in funding with that because each of these products has a dedicated funding stream that's statutory in nature, and we can't disturb that. So we'll have, if you will, a sort of a matrix description of how we fund our programs with functions down the one side and dedicated funding streams across the other. And we'll need to do some cost accounting to make sure that if 25% of an investigator is being funded by the credit union program, that they're spending 25% of their time on credit union work. But that's actually a structure that's very similar to the way we currently fund the Building Codes Division with dedicated programs in plumbing and electrical and so on. And so we've got experience with that kind of a financial structure. We've rolled this out broadly to staff and to stakeholders, and our stakeholders generally have been quite supportive. They're all taking some version of they'd like to see more details, and they're going to keep an eye on things, and they want to make sure they've got access to the people they're used to dealing with, and those kinds of things are all going to continue to be the case. But so far, we think we're in good shape. We'll roll the reorganization out as of January 1st, which will be an on-paper reorganization. Truly integrating the two divisions is actually going to take probably a year or more. The really mundane example I use is the two divisions right now have two different processes for approving travel claim reimbursements. Well, we only need one process, right? But three or four people are going to have to sit down around a table and figure out what that process is. Multiply that probably hundreds of times over other mundane kinds of things and other much more complex things, and that work will be necessary to really integrate the divisions functionally as well as culturally over the coming year. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions that you might have.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. On the crowdfunding, and specifically with the community public offerings and so forth being capped at $2,500, I heard some chatter that they're considering bumping that to $5,000. Is that, to your understanding, on the radar? Is that something we're moving toward?
I can't speak specifically to $2,500 to $5,000. I can tell you that we're continually monitoring the program and looking to be able to calibrate it to make sure that it's really meeting needs and continuing to balance that notion of what provides small businesses meaningful access to capital that they need while still maintaining a level of consumer protection that's appropriate.
Okay. Representative Buehler.
That's very helpful, your presentation. Just a point of clarification. So you oversee the pricing and selling of financial securities in Oregon?
Chair Fagan, Representative Buehler, I would say that we have responsibility for regulating activity in that sector and that we register those sellers. The pricing, we don't really have a regulatory role over with respect to securities.
Okay. What does it mean then to set and enforce standards?
Yeah, so often when if we bust somebody for running a Ponzi scheme, what we will specifically be busting them for is unlicensed sale of unregistered securities. Similarly, if someone is selling inappropriate products to an individual, this happens in securities. It's more common in things like variable annuities. We'll go after their license either either to sell securities or to sell insurance as an agent for violating a consumer protection statute. But what we don't get into is, was that security priced appropriately, or those kinds of issues.
So what happens if a financial security in statute had certain pricing and rules for its transactions? Who would be responsible for that?
Oh, okay. Yeah, pardon me. Chair Fagan, Representative Buehler. Yeah, so when I was thinking pricing, I was thinking like IPO pricing levels and those kinds of things. We do have a role to play in regulating whether the terms of a security offering were followed or not. And we would work either ourselves or in partnership with Department of Justice on pursuing cases around what is essentially financial fraud for not having followed the terms of an offering.
Are you familiar with the Business Energy Tax Credit Program and the controversy with the pricing of those securities?
I'm not familiar, not as familiar with the pricing side, but I'm familiar generally with the controversy, sure.
Have you looked into the pricing of those securities and not following the statutory guidelines for the transactions?
No, we have not.
Would that be in your purview to do so?
I don't know the answer to that. I'd have to find out.
You get the answer to those two questions?
Certainly.
And you can get those to Victoria if you'd like, and I can share them with the whole committee.
Certainly.
Representative McLean.
When you were talking about stopping the two departments and, you know, having a discussion, you talked about process. There might be two processes, and mm-hmm. so you'd want to combine the processes. Mm-hmm. Would you also be having the discussion about standards or criteria used for review of those types of issues that you're saying now three different types of businesses are reviewing?
Chair Fagan, Representative McLean, that's a great question, and that ultimately that's what I'm hoping to achieve in certain kinds of areas. Let me give you a couple of examples. This one's not quite on point, but it gets to the same theme. That insurance advocacy function that I talked about doesn't exist at all on the finance and corporate security side. So while I've got a structured way for people to call and get help with their insurance company, although I can get someone help with their bank or their credit union or their mortgage lender, I don't have nearly the same resource level or structure available for people to be able to access that for all the rest of the financial products and services that they're dealing with. And I really want to be able to broaden that function and capability. Another area is investigations and enforcement. Right now, I think I have a tendency in the agency to focus on I'm gonna look at this through the lens of securities law and look at that as administering that law is my tool, mm-hmm. as opposed to looking at six or seven tools in a toolbox, of which that's one, mm-hmm. and dealing with a problem that a person's having that may go across those kinds of statutory lines. And so that's another area where what we really want to do is break down those those product based silos, mm-hmm. and look at us at a wide array of tools for people to deal with issues. Those are both a little bit different than what you talked about, but it's the same theme of standards. And there are places where, and this is what the industries that we regulate have been really concerned about, there are places where there are meaningful, serious differences, say, between banks and credit unions, just to pick one that I'm sure you probably get contact from constituents about. And what we want to do is be able to respect the differences that are real and that are meaningful and that should be driving policy, but also take a fairly skeptical eye at those differences that aren't really meaningful, right. That just exist just because that's the way we've done it, and try to figure out ways to harmonize those where we can.
Okay. I think that's important.
Thank you.
Representative Nierman.
Thanks, Chair Fagan. So thanks for your testimony, Mr. Allen. That's this is very helpful. I'm interested in advertising. So you had the one advertisement up there about I think my car's been or they say my car's been totaled. I disagree.
Sure.
Another one I hear that's kind of similar on the radio is my barn fell in and the insurance company says it's not covered because there's moss on the roof or whatever. Mm-hmm. What drives the decision to engage in advertising?
Yeah, so this was a decision that we made about a year and a half ago. We had One of the ways that we're able to fund activity, and particularly consumer education activity, are out of settlement, national settlement agreements that we'll participate in, where an insurance company, in this case, did something bad, or some collection of insurance companies. And it goes into a fund that we can't use for regulatory activity, but we can use for education. And we had always kind of cast around a little bit of what's an effective way to do that. Well, we were looking at our advocacy function and realizing that we had a pretty good idea that while it's a useful function that helps people without direct cost get help with their insurance issues, pretty much nobody knew anything about it. And so we actually spent a little bit of time going out and doing a survey and trying to figure out what was consumer awareness of that. We were right. It was probably worse than nobody knew anything about it. And so we decided that something that we could usefully use those education dollars for was spending some money on advertising a useful product that people can make use of to get help with problems that we can resolve often without having to get into a regulatory activity at all, which I think is a win all the way around. Get people resolved on their claims issues or whatever is going on. And so we worked extensively with a firm to test the kinds of things people needed to know. We've actually got some really good demographic data on who is now beginning to know more about what services they're able to access through us, and where do we still have work to do, and those kinds of things. But that was the genesis of it, was to try to work on improving consumer education.
Can you follow? So was those two ads, to your knowledge, were those funded by that kind of money then? And if so,
yes.
How much money was involved, do you know?
The campaign overall has been about $2 million over 2 years. And that's been creative work. That's been a little tiny bit of TV, a lot of radio, visual advertising. And we try to make sure we spread that work around the state in terms of places that you'll see billboards and those kinds of things.
Good. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Representative Rayfield.
So I just had a kind of functional question. Someone's having trouble with an insurance company. They've got a claim out to the insurance company. They send them a letter for, hey, fix, this issue for a specific amount of money. Insurance company doesn't respond. So 30 days goes by, right?
Mm-hmm.
They, let's say 60 days go by. They give you a call and say, hey, they're not responding to my multiple letters. What do you do? What can you do about it?
Yeah, so what usually happens first is some interaction between our advocate and the consumer to figure out what is your policy, what does it actually say, are you really covered, those kinds of things, get them through a threshold of is this really a problem with the company. Usually it is. I'm not suggesting otherwise, but that's part of what we go through. And then we do the same thing. We tend to call the insurance company, and we have a lot of success just typically with a phone call to management of claims processing units in insurance companies and asking them to take a look at an issue and see if they can help resolve a claim. A call from the regulator is different than a call from the consumer.
Okay, follow. What if they don't call you back? What can you do?
Oh, we can do all sorts of unpleasant things.
Yeah, that's what I want to know. I want to know about the unpleasant things that you can do.
Yeah, we can.
The ugly stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
should we do a little disclaimer here for women and children at home?
The reason I asked this to give you the context is we heard a lot of that you don't have a lot of bite to be able to enforce a lot of the regulation that you do have, and so I'm kind of curious in this instance just to get a better idea.
So, in an instance like this, if a company truly is non-responsive to a legitimate request for information from the state insurance division, they can be fined and sanctioned simply for that.
Okay.
If we find that there's a pattern of that kind of practice, we can, as they say on TV, that's when the dollars really add up. And, we can start finding that there's a pattern and a practice of a problem and pursue that. We've also got the authority to order restitution as of two sessions ago that we did not have before. Kind of an odd quirk in the law that we could fine a company for violating the code, but not order them to pay the darn claim. Now we're able to order them to pay the darn claim. We don't actually use that authority explicitly very often. The threat of using it usually is enough to get a settlement that gets a claim paid if we're in that kind of a circumstance. But we now can order a claim paid. We can assess civil fines and penalties, and we can ultimately withdraw someone's ability to do business in the state.
Yeah, and last question, as a practical matter, an insurance company that has not responded in a reasonable time, 30 days, which I believe that there's rules that say that they have to do that,
mm-hmm.
that goes on. Someone gives you a call, you place a call, the insurance company responds after you've had to be involved. Do you, press the insurance company? Do you issue fines under those circumstances, or what do you do?
I would say in an isolated case, we would not likely issue fines. Ordinarily, our objective is to try to get compliance, get them to deal with the problem that they need to deal with. I will say in a perfect world, we would be very good at identifying those kinds of patterns of behavior and pursuing them. This is an area that Laura Calley, the insurance commissioner, and I have been committed to working on and improving our performance on. And so when you hear feedback about we don't have teeth, I think over the long play of history on this, I think our willingness to pursue those issues has been less than it is now. And we're working actively to rebuild the skill set within the agency and the focus within the agency to do a better job of pursuing those kind of cases.
Thank you.
Representative Foley.
Thanks. You mentioned a couple things that kind of piqued my interest a little bit. I'm curious as far as insurance, for example, does the insurance division, do they review all the different policy terms that are inside of a policy? Are there standards for what's in a policy and what's not in terms of the use of codes? Or you mentioned the one about on an insurance claim for a property claim that the property had to be completely rebuilt within a year of the claim. Because interestingly enough, I got a complaint about that very issue here about last week from somebody going, geez, this is impossible. We can't get this done in a year because the whole house, needed to be rebuilt. And just not going to happen because it happens to be right next to a river, high water, just all sorts of problems. So are those sorts of terms approved by the division?
Yeah, Chair Fagan, Representative Holvey, we have a function called Rates and Forms that the forms side of Rates and Forms is, in fact, the review of insurance forms that are used in policies and riders and those kinds of things. We're part also of a national compact, helps streamline some of that activity. But yes, those terms are reviewed for compliance with state law. Now, the question might be, for instance, in the case of the year to rebuild, would we have a reason not to approve a term that says you have a year to rebuild? And typically, in that particular case, we wouldn't. In statute, there are a number of requirements of what policies can and can't say. That vary across different lines of insurance, and what we're doing is reviewing those forms to make sure they comply with the insurance code. But there are a lot of things that people can get into a dispute with their company about that are terms that are perfectly legal terms. I would be in the same position, I'm sure you would, where you don't know that term is in your policy until something bad happens and you actually go to look it up and see what's there. That's part of what advocacy can help deal with, and I'd love to see if we can help with your constituent to try to resolve that situation. But we do review all those filings.
And follow up. And then in the world of not property, in the world of health insurance issues, do you also approve the codes that are used to identify what benefits are covered and which benefits aren't?
Well, your use of the phrase codes is throwing me. Are you talking about claims coding?
Yeah, correct.
Claims coding system, I do not believe, is something that we have a direct regulatory relationship with. I know we've been involved in circumstances where a particular provider did not want to use the claims codes, and that really becomes a contractual dispute between the medical provider and an insurer that he or she wants to process claims with. But I don't believe we have a regulatory role on what the codes themselves look like. Hmm. Now, we do have a regulatory role on the rates and forms deals with things like, can you have certain exclusions of certain kinds of conditions, or how do you deal with treatments that are considered experimental? That whole world of what can be what's covered and what's not covered is something that we have a regulatory role over.
Representative McLean.
You said something in some of that dialogue there that just piqued something else about car insurance for me.
Mm-hmm.
And this may not be a question you can answer now, and then I could call you. But when you're talking about making sure that we have adequate product for car insurance, you know, for the purposes that we're driving vehicles,
mm-hmm.
Do you have... in your mind, do you have the opportunity to look at the product before the service actually or the driving actually takes place in the state of Oregon? And my example would be TNCs. We know that there are TNCs that are functioning in the state of Oregon right now, and they're being asked to review how much insurance they should actually carry. Mm. And what I was told was that at that point, anyhow, when we were ending last session, that there weren't any TNC products that you'd had a chance to review because they hadn't arrived in your department or your office.
Right. Chair Fagan, Representative McClain. So, yes, if a new product is being offered in the state that's not been offered before, the forms review that would occur would probably be somewhat more time-consuming because it's going to involve looking at new products that haven't existed before. There's going to be some amount of actuarial analysis that's going to go on to try to vet those products and those kinds of things. But are we talking about like insurance products to cover ride-sharing drivers and those kinds of things? Yeah, there was a lot of a flurry of activity at the end of last session on trying to create a regulatory niche for which there was a need to have a product to fill it, mm-hmm. that really didn't exist and did need a little bit more time to try to mature. That's
but
right.
That's appropriate work for what you're talking about, the insurance
sure.
review.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much for that overview. That was really helpful. And that is the extent of our invited testimony on that topic. So I'm going to close the informational hearing on the overview of DCBS. And why don't we take a just like 5-minute recess, and then we're going to have our final hearing. So we'll be back in. They're going to perform over there.
Yeah.
It's not quite the Vegas act, but it's close.
Oh, I've seen that Vegas act. It's pretty cool.
Any Vegas show is amazing. They do the best.
Don't let it go too far.
Are you going to Civil War?
That's what I'm sure. Is it in Corvallis?
No, it's in Eugene.
Oh, I'll probably go then.
I'll be there too.
I'm going to the SC game.
Is that next weekend? That's the big one.
It's like day after tomorrow.
If they went out, they can probably get a decent bowl game, right? Yeah. All right, we are back, and we're going to open our final informational hearing on negative option marketing. And this is a kind of Oregonian-driven hearing on a topic. So I'm going to first bring up some Oregonians who have kind of a story to share with us, and that's David Roth and Tangela Purdom. So go ahead and come up, and then we'll have essentially two different panels follow them. And I think we'll, just like the other panels, we'll let them make their entire presentation. And then if you have any questions, ask them after their presentation is concluded. So all you need to do is state your name for the record just the first time before you start talking, and then go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Chairwoman, and members of the committee. My name is Tangela Purdom, and I'd like to... tell you how I was trapped by two negative option scams and how my credit card company Visa betrayed my trust. And in 2013, I was on a Weight Watchers website, which I trust fully, and popped up this sidebar, and I was inclined to think that the offers under that sidebar were trustworthy because they were on that website, and it was the offers that I chose were RAV and Lederm Lux cosmetics, and that was because they didn't have anything saying that it was anything else but a free offer. And the ad has a lot of symbols. You can see up here McAfee, Better Business Bureau, and others. And, of course, McAfee's well known, and so I felt, well, they aren't scammers then. The screen prominently displays the price of $0. On the advertisement I had, it also said in bold, free. And what you don't see are the terms and conditions of this offer on the screen. And that's the full first screen that you would get.
Just quickly, if you can push the microphone back a little bit.
Sure.
If you have about 5 to 6 inches between your mouth and the mic, is about perfect.
Thank you.
No problem.
So what you don't see are the terms and conditions of this offer. And the screen is actually designed so that as you view it, you can complete the transaction, get my order, without ever seeing the terms and conditions. And you know, there's just nothing to indicate that there's another screen below this that you would have to scroll down all the way to see the rest of this.
Okay.
So I pressed my green button. I gave them my credit card, and I completed the transactions. And that's for both products. Hidden below are the terms and conditions. And that print is the tiniest print you could imagine. And it says, if you cancel the order, you have to cancel the order within 10-day trial period and return all the products shipments, you agree that your card will be charged $97.88. And it's as part of this exclusive member auto ship program. Within 30 days, I had three of these packages. And so they also have a little fraudulent deal. They don't send them out monthly. They send them out right away. So a negative offer option is the one that establishes the long-term relationship and require without you ever having to check a box that says, yes, I agree, I'm going to pay $97.88 per month. So the Oregon Free Offer Statute, which is ORS 646.644, requires the terms and conditions of a free offer to be displayed as prominently as the initial price. And obviously, this advertisement violated the law on both counts. As a result, about the time that the scammers hit us, the Oregon DOJ announced a court settlement with a negative option scammer called Best Brands. Best Brands had operated in Oregon for 5 years, defrauding 5,000 Oregonians for a total of $250,000. According to a DOJ investigator, only 2 to 3 people actually made a complaint. And I think that's because if you do this, you're so embarrassed. Mm. How did I get suckered into this thing? So you kind of keep quiet about it. And I think probably most people just pay the fees and cancel and go on. When we were hit by Oravi and Leoderm Lux, we expected Visa to quickly put a stop to the payments. And what a surprise. As far as Visa was concerned, these were perfectly legitimate transactions. Here's how the fraud specialist at Advanced Credit Union explained this situation, and I'm quoting from a letter. I understand how frustrating it can be to purchase something and find out later that you are signing up for a recurring business transaction with the merchant. This happens far more than people realize and is common among many online companies such as antivirus software providers, makeup, vitamins, health products, and etc. Unfortunately, in your situation, the merchant did provide their terms and agreements and information regarding the reoccurring transaction unless canceled. And this is what Visa requires them to do. In future, I can only recommend reading through everything before you make a final purchase. This will help ensure a situation like this will not arise in the future. even though we had presented to them the small print, the fact that the screen didn't come up, and et cetera, that I've mentioned already. In other words, it's your fault you were fooled, and so neither Advantis nor Visa bears any responsibility for protecting you. We know it's a big problem for our customers, but we're not going to scrutinize these scam transactions. We're going to take the terms and conditions at face value. When I reported this fraud to the Attorney General's office, they promptly demanded that the culprits refund all of our money and warned that they would be prosecuted if they continued to violate Oregon law. Soon we had our refunds. We had notified Advantis, fraud specialist, that the AG had obtained our first refund, and she gave us a more thorough explanation of Visa's philosophy of financial ethics. Here's her response. I quote, "I am glad to hear that you were able to find some resolution, even if it meant writing a letter to the DOJ. Please keep in mind Visa is a form of payment. It is not the law or required to determine if laws have been broken. That is up to our legal system. Unfortunately, our situation, in your situation, we do not have any dispute rights through Visa because the merchant's cancellation return policy wasn't followed. Visa does not determine if a law or laws have been broken, and that is up to the legal system." Now, keep in mind, there's a lot of hypocrisy in this posture. Visa protests that they deferred to legal authorities to determine whether the credit card transaction violated state law. But when we provided them with that determination, they'd ignore it. If Visa's policy were sincere, they would have taken action against the culprits, because Visa's international operating regulations dated October 2013 establishes the right to terminate any merchant for engaging in fraudulent activity, and it requires participants like Advantis to report all fraudulent transactions and or other criminal risk activity to Visa without delay. Visa had come under some scrutiny, along with the other credit cards, in 2012. And this was, they wrote their own rules when they were confronted. And they're, of course, a self-regulatory situation. So as a result, the Visa's own operating rules weren't followed. So they have a rule that they don't follow, which is to go back and terminate the fraudulent companies. But they don't follow it. So we believe, having dealt with this for over a year, that we need government action in order for Visa to implement those rules that they wrote that are supposed to be self-regulatory. And then I'll turn it to my husband. Thank you.
Chair Fagan, other members of the committee, I appreciate very much the opportunity to make this presentation to you. It's really, as you all know, being in the consumer protection business.
Sorry to interrupt, will you please introduce yourself for the record?
Yeah. David Roth, Portland, 3936 Southeast Ankeny Street, Portland, Oregon. I really do appreciate your helping to disclose the kind of consumer protection issue we've encountered with Visa. And at this point, we've been at it for more than a year. It was 2013 this occurred. It's great that Oregon's free offer law is so clear and the AG is so vigorous about enforcing it. But the law doesn't address the role of the credit card company in the crime. According to the DOJ investigator that my wife mentioned, these scams depend entirely on the credit card system. As he put it, They don't want your cash. They don't want your check. Because they can't use them to set up a continuing payment system. They can only do that with credit cards. Hearing that, we recognized how scandalous it was that Visa refuses to use its existing authority to block these crimes. The history of Visa's policy is really surprising. In late 2009, Visa announced it would henceforth include negative option fraud in its zero liability policy, meaning Visa would reimburse its customers for any losses due to it. Here's how Visa summed the policy up. Consumers who believe they have been a victim of deceptive marketing, i.e. negative option fraud, and have not been able to resolve the issue directly with a merchant should call their Visa card issuer to dispute the charge. That's what we did. Remember, as a Visa cardholder, you are protected from fraudulent charges. 2013, Visa was telling us a very different story. They were saying it's all on us, and we don't even consider the law. We can't be expected to determine what the law requires in this case. You're going to have to go somewhere else for that. According to Visa, the new policy was based on an agreement with the FTC and Better Business Bureau. This is back in 2009, okay? Senator Rockefeller, chair of the Senate Committee of Commerce, Science, and Transportation, had weighed in on the matter, too. His committee published a report in late 2009, corresponding roughly to the date of this new policy of benign effort on Visa's part. It was entitled Aggressive Sales Tactics on the Internet and Their Impact on Consumers and negative option fraud was included as an important part of that Senate report, 2009. According to a DC financial blogger publishing about that time, Visa actually went beyond an announcement of this protection by actually going ahead and exercising their authority to stop providing services for 100 merchants who had been found to be engaging in negative option fraud. So in 2009, they knew they had the authority to act against these scams and to actually deprive their merchants of any further services. But in 2013, not anymore. Visa actions in 2009 show how cynical Visa's current policy is. It's apparent that Visa can't be trusted to live up to its commitment unless they are forced by law. That's why government entities must raise their sights from the scammers to the credit card companies. That's not just a job for the federal government. It's a job for state governments, too, because state law is being violated here with the assistance of credit card companies. If Visa denies responsibility for customers' complaints about these violations of Oregon law, doesn't that compel the state to take compensating action? Other states may have taken such action already. If so, we can borrow from them. If not, Oregon can lead the way. The president of Advantis Credit Union, our credit union, who was handling the Visa contract with us, Robert Corwin, tried to get Visa to accept responsibility for negative option fraud in this case. After Michelle Cargman of the Oregon Division of Finance and Corporate Securities asked him to cooperate with us, we had a lengthy meeting. We discussed the two scams that hit us, the Oregon Free Offer Statute, the Best Brand Settlement, and the contradiction between Visa's 2013 policy and their 2009 policy. By the end of the meeting, Mr. Corwin agreed to raise the issue personally with Visa. Initially, Visa dismissed his concerns. When he insisted on a serious discussion, Visa arranged a conference call with their security experts, who assured him that Visa had methods for protecting customers against this kind of fraud, but they wouldn't say how. Mr. Corwin sent us an email describing this meeting. He knew he was up against a blank wall, and he had to take Visa's assurances on faith. But he knew that Visa didn't protect us from the scams. It was the AG, not Visa, that got us our refunds and warned the scammers to stop doing business in Oregon. After reading Mr. Corwin's email, my wife and I agreed there was no further point in appealing to Visa's sense of corporate ethics. Our best bet was to appeal to the state and federal government. Over and over, we've heard that the only way to change Visa's policy was through the federal government. For a long time, we bought that idea. Then we began to wonder why the state couldn't put pressure indirectly on Visa. For example, couldn't the state require banks and credit unions to report customer complaints of negative option fraud to the state under state law, including information about the suspect merchant, the name of the credit card company, the name and address of the complainant, and the resolution of the complaint? Currently, the DOJ doesn't learn of a citizen's complaint about negative option fraud unless the citizen files a complaint with the DOJ themselves. In the Better Brands case, remember, fewer than 1% of the victims in Oregon of that five-year-long fraud actually filed a complaint with DOJ. Once we were told, once they had received just two or three complaints, they went after Best Brands in court and beat the stuffing out of them. My wife and I have a partial explanation for this low percentage of complaining. Besides the guilt factor, which is no doubt serious, there's another factor that can be handled in an administrative or legal way, and it's been done in other consumer issues. And it's this. Well, let me get to what they didn't do that they could have done. The fraud specialists at Advantage didn't encourage us to file a complaint with DOJ. They said nothing about the DOJ, let alone DCBS, when they were giving us this story about their not having any responsibility and it's being really quite uncertain what could be done to resolve the matter. They didn't provide us with DOJ's complaint form, fraud complaint form. They could have. They didn't tell us that DOJ could probably recover our funds if there were a crime, which they did. Instead, Visa, through Advantis, led us to believe that there was no crime as long as the criminals complied with their terms and conditions, and our losses were our own fault. They only made vague reference to the possibility of unnamed government agencies who might determine that there had been a crime, period. Nothing about restitution. We suspect that this vagueness, and this is important, this is something that has just occurred to me. We suspect that this vagueness to us wasn't just a way of shuffling aside an administrative headache or a small financial headache. We think it may very well have been motivated by a desire to discourage victims from complaining to state and federal authorities. Why else would they completely ignore the possibility of recommending to us that we go to DOJ or we go to the Consumer Protection Bureau? Surely DOJ would receive many more complaints if banks and credit unions were required to assist them with their complaints, or make a report themselves as pertaining to a violation of Oregon law. Not federal law, Oregon law. If the rate of complaint rose from less than 1% to 10% or 20%, the AG could stop negative option fraud in Oregon when there were only 10 or 20 victims, not 5,000. Consumers could also be better informed about the fraud protection policies of different credit card companies. This is the theme that Paul was raising about the opportunities for steering, giving customers, consumers, more market knowledge in order to allow them, enable them to make careful discriminations about which companies were offering the best products and the best offer, the best terms. And we think there are three ways for the legislature and the AG to work on this problem. One would be through our congressional delegation. The other, second, would be through federal courts with collaboration of other states' attorneys. That's kind of collaboration that Oregon's Department of Justice has engaged in for previous cases, including a very big one called Affinion, an insurance negative option scam. And the third would be through state legislation or administrative rules here at home. Together, these paths would constitute a complete strategy. Let me close with this. President Corwin was so discouraged by Visa's stonewalling, he would probably be grateful if the state required credit unions and banks to report these complaints. Once they had a chance to think about it, most of the other credit union and bank presidents would probably agree. They don't like having to tell people that there wasn't a crime when it becomes more and more obvious as more information comes in that there actually was. But Visa insists, you're playing on our team, you ignore it. Tell people to go home. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for such a thorough presentation, and obviously I know through interactions with my office, you guys have been working on this for a very long time, so thank you for, it sounds like you've gotten your money back, but you're trying to kind of forge ahead and help other Oregonians, and for that, we're grateful for your work.
Thank you. I think there are an awful lot of people out there that have experienced this, and it's that kind of quiet that's just under the surface, and I'm hoping this will bring it out and at least help people. I know an awful lot of people that paid that money when I started asking and talking about it.
Right. Any questions for this panel?
Thank you.
We're going to have a few. We're going to have someone from DOJ and someone from DCBS come up to kind of address some of the legal issues. But okay, well, thank you guys very much, and hope you'll stick around for the next panel. So can I have Jonathan Grew and Patrick Allen from DCBS? And Jonathan Grew, hopefully I said that correctly.
Yes.
Okay. And is from DOJ. And you guys, looks like on my list, Jonathan would go first, but I don't have a preference if you guys have.
Chair Fagan it's, and members of the committee, it's okay if I go
okay.
First. So.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Grew. I'm the attorney in charge of the Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection Section within the Oregon Department of Justice. To a degree, what I can talk to you about today is limited in terms of the limited reach of what my office can do. I want to break it into three parts. I want to discuss the law about negative options in general. I'll try to go quick through that. I want to talk about some of the cases we brought so you have a context, and I want to talk possible next steps of going forward in terms of addressing the types of issues that we just heard. To approach negative option marketing as a concept, it's good to think about fraud on a continuum. On the one hand, you have explicit types of deception where you're just simply ripped off and stolen from, and it's almost criminal, really. On the other end of the continuum, in the consumer realm, you might have more of a bad business practice, an implied understanding, a concealment of some sort. Negative option marketing can be both. It can be an explicit deception. It can be, on the other hand, it can be just a bad business practice. Not all negative option marketing is fraud. Not all of it is illegal. It's found under the UTPA, under ORA 646.608, subsection 1, SSS, subsection 1, TTT, two statutes, basically. It's under 608, which allows for private rights of action, so individual citizens can bring suit against businesses that engage in this. The state also, as you can understand, has the ability to do so as well. We do try to do so if there's a widespread violations taking place. There are two statutes, as said. One deals with what's called free offers. That's referenced in ORS 646.644. I'd like to define that for you so that you grasp what's behind it. Free offers, an offer of goods or services without cost or for a one-time payment to cover only incidental charges such as shipping and handling to a consumer that, if accepted, causes the consumer to incur a financial obligation for additional goods or services other than those initially received or enrollment in a membership or subscription, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So the statute itself defines a free offer as not necessarily free at all. That being said, it's not prohibited. We all actually have free offers we deal with regularly in our consumer transactions, but it is a disclosure and consent law. I think the example that was provided by our former consumers is very clear that it's not clear and conspicuous at all. It has to be clear and conspicuous under the law regarding the obligation before the transaction closes. And it has to require affirmative consent by the consumer to agree to the terms. Fine print is actually okay, so long as that fine print is in proximity to where the offer is being made. And this is a perfect example of that fine print being buried at the bottom where it's hard to see and find. This free offer statute and law does not apply to telecommunications and services that are regulated under the Federal Communications Act. I don't know why that carve-out exists, but it exists. The other statute deals with automatic renewal and continual service offers. It's under the credit and purchasing part of ORS 646A.292. It goes all the way to 646A.295. That is defined as a plan or arrangement in which a paid subscription or purchasing agreement is automatically renewed at the end of a definite term for a subsequent term. An example I like to think of would be like maybe subscribing to Netflix or something like that. Again, it's not a prohibition. A lot of consumers benefit from these. However, it is a disclosure consent law. Again, it has to be clear and conspicuous regarding the obligation before the transaction is entered into, and regarding how to cancel. That has to be very clear. Same thing with fine print. It's okay. It has to be very clear and conspicuous and next to the offer, and there has to be affirmative consent by the consumer. With both of these, at a minimum, the consumer must be provided with information on how to cancel and a toll-free number, so the least cost possible passed on to the consumer. This additional statute does not apply to entities regulated under the PUC, the FCC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, entities regulated by DCBS, under the insurance code, banks, credit unions, financial institutions, consumer finance companies, or trust companies licensed under state or federal law, and service contract sellers regulated under 646A.150. So I just wanted to give you that background in terms of the law itself so that we define our terms and understand going forward what our parameters are. Yes, the DOJ does receive negative option complaints. They are regular, but I would say definitely not high volume. Often the issues involve national actors as opposed to local businesses in the state. We do, for sure, coordinate with other state AG offices, as pointed out previously. And what I did is I tried to get a breakdown of the number of these cases. Over the last 6 years, overall, our financial fraud consumer protection section has received approximately 60,000 complaints. Of those, approximately 450 involved misleading free trial offers. So that's in a very broad sense. Broken down, I'm not good at math, but that's 0.75%. I thought of bringing a pie chart, but it would be like almost one color. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, I think you get the idea. With that being said, we brought cases nonetheless. It was mentioned that we brought the Infineon Web Loyalty case. We filed that in Marion County Court in 2013. That involved multiple discount clubs, membership programs where they offered credit monitoring, roadside assistance, discount to travel. We did get involved with a lot of other state AG offices on that one. They market it through marketing partners and create through banks and retailers. The consumer would make a transaction and then be solicited for this type of service, and the consumer thought it was from the retailer that it the consumer just dealt with. So that confusion was created thereby. And consumers were charged for services without authorization, allegedly. And once charged, it was difficult to cancel or get a refund. So they're getting the corporate bureaucratic stonewall. The other one mentioned best brand values. That did involve internet activity that was also involving free offers and subscriptions. Sirius XM was one, a case that we recently settled in 2014. It did involve entity regulated under the FCC. For this reason, Oregon got involved, but took more of a backseat role with other state AG offices. And we attempted to get a resolution for consumers regardless. And we did. We did ultimately get a settlement out of there that imposed injunctive terms on Sirius XM. Classmates was a more recent one. I think we filed that this last summer. And similarly, it involved membership programs and other offerings from companies sold to consumers. For all these, you know, this is four cases over the last few years. We were able to get injunctive terms. We were able to get restitution paid out to eligible consumers. To give some scope and a matter of correction, I did check the number of complaints we obtained regarding best brand values through time, 15 consumers within 24 months. That, along with other factors, led to an investigation and enforcement action. We do have criteria we have to follow. I don't know if the committee was interested in hearing that. We need it as a guideline. Basically about six factors overall. Obviously, the law has to apply. We have to be able to reach these targets with the law. Evidence has to be there. We have to have more than just, we have to have witnesses and documents that we can go into court with. Otherwise, we're skirting our ethical duty. Complaint volume can be a factor. One single complaint we might not be able to devote resources to, especially if restitution has already been obtained. But if we get a lot of complaints, even if restitution has been paid out to victims, we will consider pursuing that because clearly they're just trying to get by and there might be a huge volume out there in the population that we don't know about. Egregiousness is another factor. So we might have just a few complaints, but if the behavior is terribly wrong, obviously we'll go after that. And there's a resource issue, too. We have only X number of attorneys, 10 to 12, based upon what's going on throughout the year and other projects, 20 to 30 cases per attorney. If it's in litigation, it's less because it takes more time. So that being said, those are the cases. Those are our criteria. The final thing I want to just mention to you very briefly, going forward, what do we do? Our office is obviously all ears and willing to assist the legislature in looking at finding a way to clean up the law, make the law more effective in some fashion. We're willing to provide assistance and guidance in that regards. We're obviously always going to be willing to entertain options about going to Congress and that. We're always on the lookout regarding new cases in which we can shape the marketplace to be more positive for both businesses and consumers. So I know that's very broad and vague, but that ends my testimony.
Okay. I think we'll hear from Mr. Allen, and then we'll entertain questions for the whole panel after that. Go ahead.
Thanks very much. Chair Fagan, members of the committee, Patrick Allen, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I don't actually have very much to add. We are not directly responsible for negative option marketing regulations, those kinds of things. We don't have any regulatory role with credit card settlement companies, so we don't have a hook into Visa or MasterCard or any of those folks. There are notification requirements in place for Oregon chartered banks and credit unions that require them to provide notification to law enforcement and to the department when a fraud has occurred. In the case of banks, the bank has to have lost money in the fraud, and of course that would occur in a case like this if the bank stepped in and was the entity that paid a consumer back based on a transaction. If that were to occur, credit unions are required to make a notification anytime that they become aware of a fraud.
But I think it's becoming aware of a fraud, not aware of an alleged fraud, and so that would be a bit of a complication. The only other thing I would mention is that if you choose to move into this space, either on the notice side or other activities, it's really important. In my earlier presentation, I talked about sharing regulatory responsibility in banks and credit unions. You can only impose standards for behavior on state-chartered banks and state-chartered credit unions. You cannot impose those standards generally on federally chartered banks and credit unions doing business in Oregon. In most cases, we're preempted by federal law from regulating those entities, not entirely, but in large part. And so that'll be something that if you want to get into this space, we'll want to work closely with you on in terms of how to look at that. Be happy to answer any questions you've got.
Questions for this panel? I just had a... Oh, go ahead. Representative Holden.
Sorry. Thank you.
Hopefully it's good. Hopefully it's good.
My hand was a little slow. So I'm thinking I heard that the banks are only required to report fraud when the bank is the one that loses money, not the consumer. And is that a federal statute or a state statute?
Or a 707-735.
And so in the consumer...
And in context, I was just looking at that statute. If you read it in context, you can sort of get the sense that what that was about was if... Because it's in the director's responsibilities. If a director becomes aware of the bank losing money because of fraud, the implication being the bank being a victim of large-scale
right.
fraud. So it's kind of a bank shot to this stuff anyway.
Right.
It's really not the point of that statute, I don't think.
Right. Well, I think it's sort of indicative of some of the problems, perhaps, with our statutes, though the UTPA covers some of this for consumers, but you know your agency has a lot of regulatory schemes to. I mean, maybe schemes is not a great term, but regulatory restrictions and standards for business practices, and those in themselves are meant to protect consumers, mm-hmm. but. You know, it just sort of seems like there's a little disconnect when actually the consumer is the one that's being harmed, and those regulatory mechanisms don't really move to protect the individual consumer. They're designed to, go back to the regulatory agency and, you know, somehow get at them for not following the law in terms of their regulations. So the mechanism for the consumer in this particular case is, where does the consumer get the restitution, the remedy, and, under 608 they can, I guess, recover attorney fees as well. But were you able to recover any other costs for the consumer, their time, their effort, they've probably spent a lot of money, trying to deal with this situation. Are those sorts of things recoverable for the consumer, either through the Department of Justice under the UTPA or in your regulatory framework?
Well, I can, Chair Fagan, Representative Holden, I can certainly answer quickly for us. Since we don't have any regulations over this behavior, all we have is a reporting requirement, I would say no. There's no vehicle in law today for consumers to obtain recovery under the laws that you've charged us with administering.
Mm-hmm. Chair Fagan, Representative Holden, our limitations are we look at restitution. That ends up being pretty much a black and white issue in terms of actual loss. We'll look at penalties or sometimes there's an argument whether these are fines or not. We don't have a provision that takes into account loss to a consumer in terms of time and all that. We use that as point of argument in negotiations, but it's never really reflected in a settlement based upon our statutory limitations.
Thanks.
So what are your thoughts just in terms of, kind of a preemption issue you mentioned with the, obviously, Visa, for example, would be a federally chartered, I guess they're not a bank.
It's the banks and credit unions, actually, that are federally chartered.
So would the state have any ability to take any action and require Visa to, or maybe not Visa, but like the bank that is administering the Visa card and or Visa, to take any action in this situation when a consumer, disputes a charge under this negative option marketing, or is that something that you think is federally preempted?
I'm trying to kind of get to the Mr. Roth's point of, you know, the state law, yeah, got us our money back, but they were frustrated that when they went to their credit card company, which is obviously where they were actually losing the money, was through them, you know, being charged with the credit card company just said, well, there's nothing that we can do, even though, at least in their view, the credit card company had certain standards that it, I would at least, at the very least, say contractually was obligated to fulfill for their credit card holder, and yet they were kind of like, oh, we don't have any responsibility. I mean, is there any state law that can hold the credit card company or the bank to those terms, or is that something that's kind of beyond the purview of state law?
Well, Chair Fagan, we are limited, for sure. If we were in a scenario, I was trying to entertain different hypotheticals when Mr. Roth was talking about under what scenario could we reach in and start dealing with these Visa directly ourselves. In a scenario where perhaps this company that had engaged in the negative option had not returned the money and Visa had become very uncooperative and not remitting, we're on much more solid ground to go after that type of behavior by a credit card company. But under this type of scenario, it's harder to do so. So, again, I'm entertaining a hypothetical, so so many other factors go into play on this.
And I'm not an attorney by any means, but it is maybe useful to talk for just a second about the difference in the legal or the regulatory framework between DOJ and DCBS. DOJ gets assigned broad responsibility for categories of behavior under the UTPA and other statutes. We get assigned specific regulatory activity, typically for specific entities. And we get to regulate those entities for usually a list that you give us of things that they can and can't do, and that list is more or less exclusive. So we're not currently well situated to be able to pursue something that, even if we think it looks like it's smelly behavior, just because it's poor behavior, if we don't have the authority over that entity, we're fairly circumscribed. You could assign us authority over something like a credit card settlement company. Again, not being an attorney, I would worry about whether there is either explicit federal preemption or interstate commerce restrictions that would make it difficult for us as a state agency to try to regulate in that space.
Right. I mean, it's just as a specific example, which with Mr. Roth gave, being that when they went to their bank or their credit union, the credit union didn't say, oh, but you can file with DOJ. It didn't give them any sense. So if we were to, for example, try and pass a law to say, you know, if someone reports fraud to you or that they're, you know, disputing a charge, that you're off, that you're mandated to at least inform them. But if they're a federally chartered credit union or bank, could we even make that requirement to them?
Yeah, no, you couldn't. And so what you would hear from banks and credit unions was, if you give us a long list of things that only the state chartered entities have to do that the federal entities don't have to do, you're at some point, perhaps not on that individual piece, but collectively over time, disadvantaging us having a state charter because you're subjecting us to a lot more regulation. That's the argument that you would likely hear from them.
Okay, any other questions for this panel? All right. Well, thank you guys very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that is the extent of the invited testimony. So I'm going to close the informational hearing on negative option marketing. And with that, is there anything else for the good of the order? All right. Getting this out of here 53 minutes early.
All right. Good use of them.
Huh?
I'll make good use of it.
Okay, you better. Don't spend it all in one place. All right, with that, I'm going to close the House Committee on Consumer, the in-house interim committee on consumer protection and government effectiveness. Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government